Ms. McKenzie, are you ready?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Judge Gregory. Glad to be with you this morning.
Good to have you here.
Floyd and Quattlebaum, very nice to see you again. I'm Andrew McKenzie. I represent Reco Bethea. This case involves a conviction against Mr. Bethea, conspiracy to distribute cocaine and crack cocaine. The issue is whether it was an abuse of discretion for the district court judge to reimpose sentence on Bethea without regard to the First Step Act case. Let me say this at the beginning. We filed the original opening brief in this case back in November of 2019, last year. There was very little Fourth Circuit authority on this issue at that time. I acknowledge that during the last 11 months, there have been some cases that have come out that are not exactly favorable to Mr. Bethea's position in this case. Nevertheless, I would like to take you through the procedural posture of this case, which is a little bit different from the cases that have already been decided, and also point out a couple of aspects to this case that I think the court should at least consider before making its decision.
Mr. McKenzie, I don't grasp, but I would ask you to please address the motion to dismiss in the course of your argument, in addition to whatever substantive arguments you have as on the issues.
Yes, sir. This case started back in June of 2014 when Mr. Bethea was originally indicted. During the course of the case, there was an 851 enhancement filed by the government based on three state court convictions that meant that Mr. Bethea was facing a mandatory life sentence. There was a plea agreement where Bethea agreed to plead to the conspiracy count, agreed that he would have a life sentence, and that he stipulated to the 851 enhancement. He agreed to cooperate. If his cooperation was deemed to be substantial assistance, then the government agreed to withdraw two of the three 851 enhancements, meaning that Bethea would be facing a 20-year mandatory minimum instead of mandatory life. He also agreed to abide by all the conditions of his bond and all laws. And he waived his right to appeal. He waived the right to bring a 2255 motion. There were certain exceptions to that, including ineffective assistance of counsel. The court accepted his plea. The pre-sentence report came out. The sentencing hearing was held August of 2015. At that point, the government refused to withdraw the two 851 enhancements because it was learned that Mr. Bethea was cooked and or prepared crack cocaine during the course of the case. That was a violation of the plea agreement. He also lost his acceptance points. So at that point, after the sentencing hearing, his guidelines were set at 151 to 188 months, was approximately 12 to 15 years. That, if I read this correctly, that is the sentence that he would be facing if the First Step Act applied to his case, rather than a life sentence. But of course, the judge, his hands were tied, and he had to give him a life sentence. No appeal was filed at that time. In October of 16, Bethea filed a 2255 motion alleging several things, but most importantly that he was denied his right to appeal. He did want to appeal. He wanted his attorney to file an appeal, and he did not do so. The government contested that, and that case was in litigation for some 2.5 years. During the course of that 2255 case, the First Step came out in December of 2018. Under the First Step Act, the 851 enhancements were changed to where now they would not be facing a life sentence. He would be facing a mandatory minimum of 25 years. And more importantly, the First Step Act redefined what counts for an 851 enhancement, relabeling it serious drug felony to where the prior conviction the defendant would have to have served at least 12 months in jail on the prior conviction for it to count as an 851 enhancement. If they had no such prior convictions, he would not be facing an 851 enhancement under the First Step Act. So the court in the 2255 case issued an order in July of 2019 denying all grounds except the issue regarding the appeal. And Judge Anderson in the district court acknowledged that, you know, if the defendant alleges ineffective assistance of counsel, including the denial of the right to appeal, a hearing is required. Under Fourth Circuit precedent, a hearing must be held. And Judge Anderson did set a hearing for September of 2019. But then it was learned that Mr. Bethea had some serious medical conditions, and it was very expensive to transport him for that hearing. So, and Mr. Bethea refused to do the hearing by video. So at that point, Judge Anderson changed his mind and said, well, there's not going to be a hearing. He simply, by written order, he vacated the prior judgment and sentence and re-entered it, allowing Mr. Bethea to appeal anew. He stayed consideration of all the other claims, whereas before he denied all the other claims, he changed that and stayed consideration of all the other claims. And then the court filed the notice of appeal. So it's our position that at the resentencing, it was abuse of discretion for Judge Anderson not to disregard the First Step Act. Section 401C.
Why didn't you, Mr. McKenzie, how did your client not waive that argument? How does the plea agreement and the waiver of either appeal or a collateral attack not apply to the argument? The only exception I saw was an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, and yeah, that's not the basis of your abuse of discretion. So how is your client's position not waived?
There are exceptions to an appeal waiver or a 2255 waiver. Most importantly, one being that if it's an illegal sentence, if the judge exceeds what is allowed by law, under those circumstances, regardless of the appeal waiver, the defendant can still pursue an appeal. And that's essentially what we're alleging here, is that the first...
As I understand this provision of the First Step Act, it's not... It wasn't retroactive. So is this actually a sentence that violated the law? It seems to me it's more of a change in law type circumstances, which we've held, I think, are not the type of things that allow someone to avoid a waiver.
What we're saying is after the First Step Act was enacted, Judge Anderson vacated the sentence and then resentenced Bethea. So we're saying at that point, the First Step Act should apply because it's after the date of the enactment of the sentence. And also there was supposed to be this hearing that never took place. On the 2255 motion, there was supposed to be a hearing about the ineffective assistance of counsel involving the lack of an appeal. Now that hearing didn't happen, but if it had happened, I suspect that Judge Anderson would have ruled the same way he did. And when he did that, well, then the First Step Act issue presents. That is the first, it could have been argued that, well, now you've got to apply the First Step Act. And I think that's an argument that should have been made. But Bethea never had the chance to do that because Judge Anderson canceled the hearing.
How do you deal with the argument that the First Step, that the particular provision of the First Step Act here applies if a sentence for the offense has not been imposed as of the date of enactment? And the government says a sentence has been imposed. It it admittedly was vacated, but a sentence was imposed. So how does the text of the statute not, you know, prevent the applicability of the relief you seek under the First Step Act?
Well, I don't think that necessarily forecloses this argument. It doesn't say any sentence. I mean, it doesn't say an original sentence or an initial sentence or any sentence. It says a sentence. So I think that leaves open, I understand there's cases that say otherwise, but I think that still leaves open this argument to be made. Going back to the hearing, you know, this is one of the things that's different about this case, and I think perhaps this court should consider it. But they had no chance to raise the First Step Act in district court, and I think that would have come up had that hearing been held. I don't know if Judge Anderson would have entertained it. I don't know if he would have listened to an argument or a motion. But just reading the transcript of the case, I suspect that maybe just from the statements he made in court and the wording of his orders, I think he might have at least listened to that. I think another thing that's different about this case is the finality of the judgment or sentence. And I know there is some case law that is against us on this, but I want you to consider that Bethay, at the time of the First Step Act, he never got out of district court. I understand the cases, Fourth Circuit cases, talking about, well, the First Step doesn't apply to a case on appeal. Bethay had never even gotten that far yet. He was still in district court. The appeal had not even been filed. You know, as we sit here today, Bethay, his direct appeal and his 2255 motion are both still pending. If the court rules against Mr. Bethay in this case, he goes back to district court to conclude his 2255 case. So I just think that that's something that the court should consider. His case never got to appeal at the time of the First Step Act. And that's the gist of our argument. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Well, my question to you, Mr. McKenzie, is the appeal waiver valid? And if not, why? I mean, I don't see anything in the record that creates invalidity of that appeal waiver.
The appeal waiver is valid, but there are exceptions to an appeal waiver. What we're saying is that, you know, at the time of the resentencing, the vacator of the order and the resentencing, the law had changed, and the First Step Act should have applied at that point, and therefore the sentence that he got exceeded what was allowed by law.
Right, in this case, what you're saying that the appeal waiver and applying, given a sentence that's consistent with law, not inconsistent here, they're compatible. Because he still pleads guilty. Correct?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that, Your Honor.
I'm saying enforcement of the waiver, at this point, it really doesn't matter because his sentence was vacated, and so he had to be sentenced again. Right?
Yes, sir, Your Honor.
Right, so he's not asking to surmount a waiver. All he's saying, he wants to be sentenced according to what the law was at the time of the sentencing, which 401 had amended 841. So that even if that his waiver was still there, he's trying to get the legal sentence. I think that's what his claim is, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, and even if there is a valid waiver of appeal, it's well established that doesn't mean that the judge can just do whatever he wants. He doesn't submit himself to the whim of the district court judge. He still has to be sentenced pursuant to law.
Right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Hall?
DeHall, like down the hall and to the left.
All right, Mr. DeHall.
All right, good morning, Your Honors. Chief Judge Gregory, may it please the court. Andrew DeHall here on behalf of the United States. I'd like to begin where the other argument left off with, is, which is with the appeal waiver. As my friend on the other side has said, there isn't a validity problem here. Instead, he's relying on the principle enunciated in Johnson and other cases that an illegal sentence, one that exceeds the statutory maximum, creates an exception to an otherwise valid appellate waiver. We don't think that the sentence here, certainly the one originally imposed and then just mechanically reimposed, violates either the original law or the amended one. Under the First Step Act, the statutory maximum remains a life max. I noticed that Mr. McKenzie talked about not getting a chance to raise this issue below. We would just reiterate, as we did in our brief, that Mr. Bethea is a very a good pro se litigant. He's had very detailed filings, and one of those filings was an amended 2255 petition that he filed back in April of 2019, several months after the First Step Act became effective. He could have raised it there, and as far as not getting a hearing on it, I think the hearing in scope was to be confined to whether there was ineffective assistance counsel on the appellate issue. So I'm not sure that even if Judge Anderson had found plea counsel, Mr. Delgado, ineffective, that it would have necessarily followed that a resentencing would have happened, because really what Judge Anderson did was give Mr. Bethea the common and logical remedy for failure to appeal, which this court in Haddon and other cases has said does not entitle someone to a new resentencing, and it constitutes a correction of a sentence rather than a resentencing.
So, Mr. DeHall, if you could spend a little more time on this issue, in terms of whether it sounds like there's no issue about the waiver is effective. The issue is whether the sentence, you know, is in violation of the law, is illegal in effect. And it seems like the argument is, well, at the time of the second sentence, that it was, that to sentence him as he did was to sentence him in a way that was contrary to the law. So how, help us with that issue. Do we not look at the second sentence? And if so, why? And if we look at the second sentence, how is it in compliance with the law?
Thank you, Judge Qualbaum. To answer those, hopefully in order, I think context is important here, because there are cases out there, I'm sure Your Honors are familiar with them, that talk about whether this act applies after a sentence has been vacated for a, quote, plenary resentencing on appeal. And to the extent that the panel finds those opinions informative, this is a different type of vacator. This is one not done because of a defect in the sentence or the conviction, which is the whole premise of really, quote, wiping the slate clean for a plenary resentencing. This is something done mechanically in order to restart the clock on the direct appeal time. And so really, even if Judge Anderson had found Mr. Delgado was ineffective, which he didn't, I mean, this was just something done as a quote, expedient. I think that it would be, it's not quite the right focal point to look at the second reimposed identical sentence just because the nature of it is not tied to a court found defect at all. Now, to your second question, I'd say even if you disagree with me on that, I think it's still not contrary to law, because the plain language of the act has a historical focus of asking whether a sentence had been imposed as of December 21st, 2018. And the answer here plainly is yes.
But that's substantively right. That's not about the waiver. Is that that second argument doesn't have anything to do with the waiver, or maybe it does? Or is that your argument why it's not illegal? I think I understand what you're saying.
Right, Your Honor. I have bled into the merits there. Yes, sir. Chief Judge Gregory, I think you had a question.
No, you're saying that under the new law, we can sentence it to life, a life sentence without possibility of a parole under the new law?
My reading of the amended 841 is that that life is the statutory max on that.
Without parole? Because that's the sentence he gave him.
He did give him mandatory life. That is correct, Your Honor.
Mandatory without the possibility of release.
That's correct.
That's not consistent with the law now.
Well, it would not, if, see, that kind of puts the cart before the horse, Your Honor.
What cart am I putting before a horse? I'm asking you a direct question, right in the horse's mouth. The question is this: is that permitted under the law now, as amended by 401?
If Mr. Bethea qualifies under the act, then no, that would not be permitted.
Okay.
Right. Right, and I'm sorry, when I use that turn phrase, I mean that to get there, you're kind of looking at the merits in order to decide whether the waiver applies in the first place. That was what I meant by that, and I apologize for being unclear.
But it sounds like what you're saying, as I understand it, is the reason we don't look, your argument is that because of the nature of this the way Judge Anderson vacated the judgment in order to, you know, start the appeal time again, that we don't look at whether the sentence complied with the law. This sounds like you're saying the nature of this proceeding is why we don't do that. Is that what I'm understanding?
Yes, Your Honor. That's what I'm saying.
You said that, you said because the way that the district court did this, that makes it different. The fact that it didn't give a hearing at all and just canceled it and imposed that makes the difference. That deprives us from looking at what a legal sentence would have been after vacature. Is that what your argument is? I didn't hear you make that argument. But is that your argument? Because the way it was done here, that after the vacature, that you don't have to comply with a legal sentence?
My argument, Your Honor, is that his sentence on reimposition was legal.
You just told me that it's not consistent with the new law.
You know, Your Honor,
circle again.
I apologize, Your Honor.
I think you were trying to adopt what Judge Qualibaum said was your argument, but I didn't think you made that argument, because it can't be. Basically, the district court speaks by its orders and papers. An order was no hearing, basically, and then he imposed the same sentence, life without the possibility of release. And to say that the nature of that changes the law, and the obligation of the law after vacature, still requires, the law is a stubborn fact. It just doesn't go away. You got to comply with the law. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I would argue that Judge Anderson did comply with the law, because then this gets into the merits of that. The act does not apply to, or did not apply.
I wish you would stop giving the judge's name. It's the district court. I think that it's about the district court we talked about. It's not the district judge, it's the court. So
yes, Your Honor.
The court did not get what right? What did you say? He got it right. He sentenced, but you said that if that sentence was not consistent. You just said that. And we don't know what the judge would have done in that hearing, but we do know what happened, that he was sentenced to the same sentence. And that's not consistent with the law now.
Your Honor, we maintain the position that it was consistent with the law now, because the act does not apply to Mr. Bethea on any type of resentencing or reimposition of judgment, because one was already entered as of December 21st, 2018.
But that's gone, though. Isn't that gone? That's what a vacature is. It doesn't exist anymore. You have to be focused on, because we're looking at this retroactively, it's like if someone was sentenced three times and all three were set aside and vacated in the last one, you can ignore the last one because the ones that were vacated a year ago, that's a sentence. You have to look at what present time. That's what vacate means. It's dissolved. It doesn't exist. So a sentence has to be based upon the sentence that we're looking at, whether or not that sentence would meet the new guidelines under the First Step. That turns temporal adjudication on its head.
Mr. DeHall, let me ask you two questions. One, there was no plenary resentencing in this case, was there?
Correct, there was not.
And if we were to agree with the defendant on remand, what happens? And well, before you answer that, everybody's been talking about parole. There is no parole in the federal system. Am I right about that?
That's my understanding, Your Honor.
So if we were to vacate this sentence, send it back, would there be a plenary resentencing or what?
Well, I think the most immediate thing that would happen is the district court would resume the 2255 proceedings that is left in abeyance and hasn't concluded yet. So at that point, it would then rule on the other issues that are still out there. And if it were to, it could then either find that there was some sort of ineffective assistance of counsel requiring relief or not. I don't believe remanding at this point would necessarily result, unless the court were inclined to have that sort of mandate, would lead directly to a plenary resentencing. Because there, again, this is not a case where any sort of defect in his sentence or his conviction has been established.
You don't think that would be just, that the court would be clearly, we know that the range is now 25 to life, and they don't think that's appropriate? And see, if the court, the indication that there was no option other than to give life without release, is that the government's argument in these cases, of these draconian sentences? I'm not talking about this case, and just these long sentences that now we know First Step was meant to correct some of these things. And that's why there's a change. And you're saying that's not appropriate for the court to be informed that the range is 25 to life, but not mandatory life? And I know there's old now, but when you say without release, there are other things like the geriatric provisions and those things like that. Well, without release, if it's not without release, you may not be eligible for those in terms of the things like that. So it has some implication, notwithstanding that there's no parole for anybody, but life with no possibility of release has some implications, I would think. You don't think that that's just in the sense that should be sentenced knowing that the range is 25 to life and not a mandatory life? I'm just asking, is that the government, that's the United States government in cases, a case like this? How was that just?
Your Honor, I appreciate that this gets into some line drawing questions that have been tough to wrestle with. And this court in Jordan and the Seventh Circuit in Pearson and others have acknowledged that Congress drew a line, and it might not be always one that everyone would follow or draw it the same way. But we're here to have that line enforced.
I don't think you established any line at all today. Instead, if anything has been enforced, is that it really does apply the first step done. This is not a case where I'm saying justice requires to step over a line that's clearly demarcated. I'm saying, why would you step over when we know that it does apply?
Well, Your Honor, we're not saying that it. I'll start again. We think the line is in the statute at section 401C, and the line is drawn at whether a sentence had been imposed as of that date.
And you think it doesn't matter the fact that it was vacated, has nothing to do with it?
We think that the text of the statute does not take that into consideration, but Your Honor, even if it does, say, for example, you were taking, you were agreeing with the majority in the Seventh Circuit's decision, Uriarte. Their decision was that vacator would apply in the case for plenary resentencing, as long as that took place before December 21st, 2018. So our position is that even if you wanted, if you agree with their analysis there, and we agree with the dissent's analysis in that case, but even if you agree with the majority analysis there, we have a different type of vacator here than the one that they were relying on. And second, even they didn't go so far as to say that a vacator that took place months after the First Step Act became effective would trigger the amendments. And in fact, in footnote 3 of their opinion, they suggest that it would not.
Are these facts in the same circumstance as these facts here? It's not the same facts. Plus, first of all, it's not controlling anyway.
Agreed. The facts are slightly different in that case, there was an error found in Mr. Uriarte's sentence on direct appeal, and they had there was a vacator for resentencing there.
So they had a hearing there, didn't you?
Yes, Your Honor. On remand, there was a hearing.
Right. You don't have a hearing here.
Correct. I think that does distinguish us from that case, because
that makes the vacator even more plenary here, because it's just gone.
I think it's an interesting mechanism that we're dealing with here. The summary vacator and you know, 20 minutes later, the same substantively same J and C is entered in order to start the clock again. That's why I think I agree with then Judge Barrett's dissent to say that tying it to a nature of a vacator or getting into to what kind of vacator is involved is not really consistent with what the act directs, and creates some problems with trying to parse what counts and what doesn't. But I do think that to the extent we're wondering why Judge Anderson, I'm sorry, Your Honor, the district court did that, I think he was given no reason to think that any sort of relief or ineffective assistance.
Are you speaking for the district court? Can you do that?
No.
I didn't think so. It's not in the record.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. All I was saying is that
you're speculating about something.
Well, no, Your Honor. All I'm saying is that he was given no reason to think that Mr. Bethea wanted any other type of relief for ineffective assistance on the appellate issue than the standard type that this court has approved and that district courts provide. That's all I was saying.
Was there a hearing for given an opportunity to do that, to say what he may or may not?
There was no hearing in this 2255 proceeding, Your Honor. Correct. I seem about out of time. I'm happy to answer any other questions that the court may have.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Ms. McKenzie, you have some time reserved.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, it's off. You're unmuted.
Sorry about that. The only other thing I have to add is that if Bethea is sentenced under the First Step Act, he cannot be sentenced with an 851 enhancement. His prior convictions do not qualify for an 851 enhancement at all. He is not, theoretically, he could still get a life sentence, but what would happen is he's going to be sentenced by the guidelines, most likely, which would mean a sentence of 12 to 15 years, just to show the significance of what's going on here. And that's all I really have to add. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you, counsel. I note, Mr. McKenzie, that you are court appointed, and I want you to give us special thanks on behalf of the court, because we rely upon lawyers like yourself to take these assignments in these very important cases, and we really appreciate that. Mr. DeHall, obviously we recognize your very able representation of the United States here today as well. We can't come down and shake your hand, but please know that we are very pleased and thankful that your arguments to help us on these cases, and we hope that you will be safe and stay well. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.